All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's October 22nd. And let's see, we're in the middle of the endocrine chapter, pretty much. We got done talking about a number of things last time. Let's see if I have any announcements. I don't think I have any announcements for you. All right, so I don't know. Who's got any questions? So the test, I don't have the syllabus in front of me, but we were supposed to have the test on Thursday of next week.
No, you already postponed it to November 7th.
Okay, and then we postponed it until?
November 3rd.
Until Tuesday.
Yeah.
Right, so it's going to be a week from this coming Tuesday. Right, so that's the deal. So yeah, that's what's going to happen. And what's going to be on the test? It's going to be 9, 10, and 11. Chapters 9, 10, and 11, right. All right, so make sure you get your exam figures down and work the online study questions and, you know, the whole study guide, just like before. Okay, so let's see. Just to recapitulate what we talked about last time a little bit, we looked in detail at some second messenger system, some G protein coupled kinds of receptors. For instance, receptors that control glycogenolysis in the liver in particular. And there's two important receptors that bind epinephrine. There's a beta adrenergic, right, and alpha adrenergic receptors. And through a cascade of effects while activating different G proteins, it's going to hydrolyze glucose from glycogen, and then it's going to be converted to glucose-6-phosphate, and then there's a phosphatase that chops off the phosphate so that the liver can put glucose into the blood, right? For instance, when blood glucose levels are low. And alpha-adrenergic receptors, I think you're familiar with already, work through a calcium second messenger system. The beta-adrenergic work through a cyclic AMP second messenger system. These work together, so these are synergistic effects in the liver for maintaining blood glucose levels. All right, then we talked about how glucose enters a cell. And you should, of course, be aware that glucose cannot enter cells all by itself. And why is that? You should understand the basic physical chemistry. Why can't glucose enter a cell by itself? Because it is a hydrophilic compound, can't get through the cell membrane. And so it needs help in order for that to happen. And it needs a transporter molecule that works by facilitated diffusion. So glucose still has to go from high concentration to low, but it needs to work through GLUT4 transporter. And the insulin receptor, or insulin is the passport that allows glucose to enter the cell, because insulin causes the insertion of GLUT4 transporters into the plasma membrane via the tyrosine kinase receptor. All right, so here we see the tyrosine kinase receptor. It dimerizes when it binds insulin. It activates an enzyme on the interior part of the cell, which phosphorylates various tyrosine residues in various proteins that are inside the cell, which have some kind of regulatory effect on the insertion of these endosomes that have functional GLUT4 transporters into the plasma membrane. And when they're put into the plasma membrane, then of course glucose can move down its concentration gradient into the cell. And I don't know if there's anybody that really knows what all these different signaling molecules are yet, but of course this is a very important scheme to understand how diabetes mellitus works or develops inside people. So of course we're really interested in knowing all of these pieces. Maybe in our lifetime we'll figure that out and we'll be able to treat diabetes much more efficiently if we know all of these particular steps right here. Okay, so what you should know is the GLUT4 transporter is inserted into the membrane when there is an insulin signal, if the insulin receptor is working properly and if this cascade of effects right here is working properly. But of course in a disease process they might not be working properly. And then last we closed with some other information that is really nice to know, and that there is another mechanism that can insert these GLUT4 transporters into the cell membrane, especially of muscle cells. And it doesn't have to rely on an insulin signal. And that is, that's right. And you should say exercise, yeah, right? Exercise is so important. So exercise can circumvent this tyrosine kinase receptor, for instance, if it's misbehaving, and maybe some of these other regulatory processes inside cells. So exercise is very important for controlling blood glucose. Okay, so let's move on to the next gland, which is the pituitary gland. Sometimes it's called the hypophysis, right? It's below the hypothalamus. And so here is a view of the pituitary gland. I'm not going to ask you to know a lot of anatomy of the pituitary gland, but you might recognize from this slide right here that the pituitary gland really is two different organs, two different glands. The posterior lobe is actually made out of neuronal tissue, and it's a continuation of the hypothalamus, and it's connected to the hypothalamus by the infundibulum. So there are nerve cell bodies in the hypothalamus, which then send tracts down into the posterior pituitary, and those tracts, the axon terminus of those tracts, then release neurohormones at the appropriate time. The anterior pituitary, on the other hand, really is glandular tissue. It's not neuronal tissue, but they function together. The hormones from the anterior pituitary are controlled by other hormones that are released from the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus does have control of release of hormones from the anterior as well as the posterior pituitary gland. One is via tracts and the other is through a portal system that goes from the hypothalamus into the anterior pituitary. And who can tell me what a portal system is? What's a portal blood system? And give me an example of where maybe you have seen a portal system before. Okay. Well, I maybe heard a lot of good answers, but it got all smushed together and I couldn't hear a thing. Oh, hepatic portal vein. Yeah, so what is that portal system all about? What's a portal system all about? What's the usual kind of circulation that we have in the body? We've got, what's that? We've got a heart. The heart pumps blood through what kind of vessel? What kind of vessel takes blood away from the heart? Artery, right? So here's an artery. Takes blood away from the heart. All right, and then we got these things right here. These are capillaries. And then here's another blood vessel that takes blood to the heart. And that's a vein, right? Just by definition. These are capillaries right here. This is a typical kind of circulation, whether it's a systemic circulation or pulmonary circulation. It's exactly the same thing. And which one of these blood vessels, the vein, artery, or capillary, is specialized for exchange? Can exchange take place in an artery?
No.
Can it take place in a vein?
No.
Only in a capillary, right? So the capillary is specialized for exchange. And you should know why that is. Why can exchange take place in a capillary? Because though that's the only blood vessel that's thin enough to allow for exchange, and as a matter of fact, different kinds of capillaries have different size holes in them or fenestrations that even allow fluid to leak out. Nothing can move out of an artery or vein because they're way too thick and they're too continuous for material to move out. So this is a typical kind of circulatory pattern. So when blood leaves the heart and then when it returns to the heart, how many capillary beds does it pass through? Just one. That's a typical circulation. But with the portal circulation, what do we have? We've got two capillary beds back to back like this. All right, so here is capillary bed number one. Here's capillary bed number two. And this is really nice. For instance, this might be the hepatic portal circulation where these are capillaries in the digestive tract. So toxins and food materials enter the first capillary. All right, so digestive system. And that blood then is taken to the liver. And those materials can leave the blood and be detoxified by the liver, right, before those compounds get back to the circulation of the body and cause problems. So a portal, and here's the portal vessel, the hepatic portal vessel. So a portal system is a special delivery system so that whatever is put into the blood doesn't go everywhere in the body. Maybe it might be because of dilution problems or for toxicology problems. All right. So remember, a portal system is what? A door-to-door special delivery system. So that a compound doesn't have to go through the whole circulation, including what? Maybe the pulmonary circulation. Okay. So in the pituitary gland, there is a portal circulation as well, where we have capillaries in the hypothalamus, which is connected to a portal vessel in the infundibulum, which then supplies a second capillary bed in the anterior pituitary. Okay. Posterior pituitary. All right, so what are some landmarks right here? We got hypothalamus, we got the optic chiasma, and here is that infundibulum. The posterior pituitary is not controlled by that portal system, and we call that the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal system. That's in your slides a little bit later on, so you should be familiar with that term. All right, the posterior pituitary releases two hormones, and those two hormones are antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin. All right, and they're produced by the cell bodies in these nuclei in the hypothalamus, the paraventricular and the supraoptic nucleus. And then the hormones are transported by axonal transport down into the posterior pituitary. And when these neurons are stimulated and an action potential reaches the axon terminus, then they release respectively either antidiuretic hormone or oxytocin. So the posterior pituitary stores and releases these hormones. Another name for antidiuretic hormone is vasopressin. So people use these terms interchangeably. All right, so from this slide, you should know posterior pituitary releases ADH and oxytocin, or vasopressin and oxytocin. All right, so the actions of ADH is that it conserves water in your body. All right, it decreases urine output. And it so urine output then is decreased and very concentrated with salt, so you maintain water balance in your body. Oxytocin, on the other hand, is a smooth muscle stimulant. It causes smooth muscle to contract, right, especially of the reproductive tracts during parturition, of the uterus during parturition. And oxytocin also, after parturition, produces the milk letdown reflex when an infant is nursing. So it causes contraction of smooth muscle of glandular tissue of the breast, right, which produces the milk letdown reflex. All right, that's the posterior pituitary. Anterior pituitary, we see, is controlled by the hypothalamus as well. All right, but here is the first capillary bed. Here's the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel, and that goes to the anterior pituitary. These neurons of the hypothalamus will release hormones that will stimulate the release of other hormones from the anterior pituitary. So in most cases, we call these hormones released by the hypothalamus releasing hormones or releasing factors. They actually go by the same name, releasing hormone or releasing factors. So essentially the anterior pituitary is glandular tissue, but it's still under the control of the nervous system. So this also shows you a nice interface or interaction between the nervous system and endocrine system, right? And to really appreciate one or the other, right, you really have to realize that the nervous system and endocrine system function together, and you should really consider it maybe one system, the neuroendocrine system. Okay. So what are all the hormones that are produced or released by the anterior pituitary? We've got six trophic hormones that maintain the size of various target tissues. Now, what does a target tissue have to have to be a target tissue? It's got to have a receptor to that particular hormone. And what can you use to describe the interaction between a hormone and its receptor? Okay, the binding of a hormone to its particular receptor in some target organ someplace. Right, a lock and key model would be really good, right? The shape of the hormone has to be complementary to the shape of the receptor in order to have binding. And then that allows for what? Specificity. Right, high affinity for the receptor for that particular hormone. All right, so here are the hormones that we're going to look at. Prolactin, growth hormone, thyroid stimulating hormone, adrenal corticotropic hormone, follicle stimulating hormone, and luteinizing hormone. All right, so this is a really nice exam diagram for you guys to help memorize all of this kind of stuff. Now, prolactin and TSH and ACTH, FSH, LH, and GH, where does it come from? So don't get lost on kind of the big picture by memorizing the detail. Where do they come from? The pituitary gland, but remember, pituitary gland has got two parts. There's an anterior and a posterior part. So you got to know which part too. Okay? So somehow you got to practice memorizing that one, and maybe this picture right here will help you. It comes from the anterior pituitary gland, not the posterior. So remember, posterior releases oxytocin and ADH, but none of these right here. Okay. So prolactin promotes the development of glandular tissue in the breast, right? And this, of course, happens during pregnancy and then after pregnancy if an infant is indeed nursing, right? Prolactin does not produce the milk letdown reflex. It doesn't promote the expulsion of milk from the breast, but it promotes the development of the glandular tissue so that it can secrete milk. So as a matter of fact, I could maybe just for fun right now ask you, what is the hormone that causes the ejection of milk from the breast?
Oxytocin.
That is oxytocin, right? Not prolactin. Okay, but of course oxytocin won't work unless there is prolactin that is making this glandular tissue proliferate during gestation. And as a matter of fact, it does proliferate even during the menstrual cycle as well. Okay. Growth hormone causes protein synthesis, right? Causes the growth of bone and adipose tissue and bone. And that's released from the anterior pituitary. Thyroid stimulating hormone maintains the health of the thyroid gland, and it causes the release of thyroxin, which would be T3 or T4 that we looked at already, right? And without thyroid stimulating hormone, right, the thyroid gland is going to regress and atrophy. As a matter of fact, all these other tissues are going to regress and atrophy if their trophic hormones are absent. All right, so that's the importance of the anterior pituitary. And if there is a pituitary tumor that's secreting too much thyroid-stimulating hormone or any of these hormones, then, of course, these target tissues here are overstimulated. They will hypertrophy as a result. Okay, so you take the hormone away, it atrophies. If there's too much, then it hypertrophy. So we're going to look at some control mechanisms which maintain the proper size and activity of all these different target tissues. All right, ACTH stands for adrenal corticotropic hormone. The adrenal cortex, right, is the superficial layer of the adrenal gland. And maybe from anatomy you can remember where the adrenal gland is. Where is that at? It's just superior to the kidney. Right? And the cortex is the most superficial layer right here. It's dependent on ACTH, and the adrenal cortex releases aldosterone and cortisone. We'll take a look at what those hormones do in just a little bit. Right? And remember that the adrenal medulla secretes other kinds of factors. Who can remember anything about the adrenal medulla? That might be an exam figure from the previous chapter, like autonomic nervous system. It releases epinephrine and a little bit of norepinephrine when it's stimulated by the sympathetic nervous system that goes to the adrenal medulla. So the cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fibers in the typical sympathetic outflow pathway. All right, the last two hormones, FSH and LH, right? FSH and LH work on the gonads, either the ovary or the testes. Follicle stimulating hormone is the hormone that's necessary for producing gametes. All right, and gametes are different whether they're coming from an ovary or a testes. We don't talk too much about this, but a biology class would talk a lot about this. Could anybody give me the specific name of a gamete? I don't care what kind of sex it is at the moment. What's a gamete? A sperm is a gamete, or an egg. Okay, and just for fun, how many chromosomes does a somatic cell in your body have? Like, that means most of the cells in your body has 46 chromosomes, all right, but they're in a special arrangement. They're in pairs, right? So you have two pairs of 23, and if you add up all 23 for both pairs, then you have 46. All right, so where do you get that first pair of chromosomes from? You get it from your mom, and the second pair you get from your dad, right? So that's why you have pairs of chromosomes, because you get one from each of your parents. All right, so a gamete has just 23 chromosomes in it. It just has one set. And when a sperm cell and an egg cell unite, then you get back to having the proper number of chromosomes, which is 46, right? Just two pairs. What do you call that process when a sperm and egg unite? Yeah, fertilization. Even without taking this class, you would probably know that. That's fertilization. And just for fun, what is that cell called that is produced by fertilization? That's a zygote, right? So gametes, which are sperm and eggs, have half the number of usual chromosomes that you have in your body, but when they unite, you get back to the typical number, and then a zygote. So we were all a zygote at one particular time. How do you get from being a zygote to where you are right now? What's that process called? Yeah, mitosis is real important for growth, right? And what's the process that produces gametes, that takes a cell that has 46 chromosomes and it produces a cell with half the number? Okay, that is meiosis, right? Okay, so this process, FSH, stimulates, right, the development of gametes, either eggs in the ovary or sperm in the testes. And because the structure that produces eggs in the ovary is actually called a follicle, so that's how that was named, follicle-stimulating hormone. So FSH has similar kinds of effects in both gonads. Luteinizing hormone, on the other hand, has kind of different effects. In the female, it pretty much causes ovulation right at mid-cycle of the ovulatory cycle. It causes ovulation of an egg, right, and that egg is hopefully going to find its way into this fallopian tube for fertilization, as opposed to wandering around someplace in the abdominal or pelvic cavity. LH in the male, of course, doesn't cause ovulation because males don't ovulate. Sperm are made continuously through their whole lifetime. Right, but LSH is important for stimulating cells that produce testosterone. So LH actually stimulates testosterone production. So LH, ovulation in the ovary, but testosterone production in the testes. All right, so let's see what my next slide is. Okay, that kind of just goes over things that I talked about already. But what I really want to, for you to appreciate, okay, are these releasing hormones from the hypothalamus. All right, so we said that each of the trophic hormones from the anterior pituitary are released by stimulation from a trophic hormone from the hypothalamus. So let's start with the thyroid gland. So here is kind of the thyroid gland right here. Thyroid gland is going to release thyroxine. All right, and what causes the thyroid gland to release thyroxine? You've got the anterior pituitary gland right here, releasing into the blood thyroid stimulating hormone, TSH. Okay? And what causes the anterior pituitary to release thyroid-stimulating hormone? You've got the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus is going to release TSH, R, and you could call it two different names, RF, or TSH, RH. Releasing factors and releasing hormones are basically the same thing. So people just call them different things. And your book might even have another name every once in a while. So releasing factors come from the hypothalamus, causes the release of trophic hormones from the anterior pituitary, and then those trophic hormones find their particular target tissue because they have the proper receptor for it. All right, what's another hormone that we're going to look at? FSH, FSH, and LH. Since they are trophic hormones on the gonad, sometimes we call these gonadotropins. Both FSH and LH are called gonadotropins because they stimulate the ovaries and the testes to do their particular jobs. All right. And so sometimes a gonadotropin is just abbreviated GN. That's a gonadotropin. So what are the two kinds of gonadotropins? You got FSH and LH. And where does FSH and LH come from? The anterior pituitary. And what causes the release of gonadotropins? All right, so from the hypothalamus is going to release GN, gonadotropin, that's what that stands for. Gonadotropin, what? Releasing hormone. Or if you want to call it releasing factor, that's fine with me. GnRH is going to go to the anterior pituitary, and it's going to cause the release of gonadotropins, right? FSH and LH, which are then going to go to the gonads and stimulate whatever the gonad should be doing, right? Oogenesis, spermatogenesis, testosterone production, or whatever. All right, so from the hypothalamus, in every case, it's going to be a releasing factor that's going to be released. What's another good one? How about this guy right here? What's that? Adrenal cortex. All right, so what maintains the adrenal cortex? ACTH, adrenal corticotropic hormone. And how does your body maintain the proper level of ACTH? Because, why? There is, what, the anterior pituitary. Right here, anterior pituitary is going to release ACTH, and the anterior pituitary gets its signals from the hypothalamus. Right, and what is that signal? That is ACTHRF. Or if you want to say RH, that's fine with me. All right, so we could do this, another four times, but I think you kind of get the picture, right? The hypothalamus releases releasing factors, which then affect the anterior pituitary to release trophic hormones that have different target tissues in the body. Okay, so hypothalamus always releases releasing factors. How do these releasing factors get from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary in every case? Okay, who can tell me? Yes, it's a big long term. The hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal vessel. All right, so that's how it gets there. That portal blood vessel takes it directly there. And so the hypothalamus can just secrete very, very small levels of releasing factors because it's not diluted out in the whole circulation. It goes directly from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary. So it's a very efficient system for controlling the anterior pituitary gland. Okay, so there's that portal system. Okay, so I think I talked about this whole slide already. All right, the release of anterior pituitary hormones is controlled by hypothalamic releasing and in some circumstances inhibiting factors and by feedback from levels of the target tissue, it maintains homeostasis. All right, so I think I talked about all this stuff already too. This part of the hypothalamus we call the median eminence. You know, I think that's not so important unless you have a question in your exam study guide. You should just know anterior pituitary, posterior pituitary, and what hormones are released from those two tissues. Okay, so what about maintaining homeostasis? Usually, homeostasis is maintained by what kind of feedback? Negative feedback, right? Okay. Well, we see a number of glands right here, and some of the feedback loops are what we call short feedback loops, and some are long feedback loops. All right, so here is the hypothalamus that's going to be secreting releasing hormones, like GnRH, for instance. Right, that goes to the anterior pituitary via that portal system. And the anterior pituitary is going to release what as a result of GnRH? What's a gonadotropin? Something that causes the gonads to do their job, like FSH and LH. So the anterior pituitary is going to secrete FSH and LH. Then it goes to the ovary or the testes, and they're going to be releasing, right, either estrogens or androgens, depending on the gender of the individual, and those hormones go into the blood. All right. So in order to maintain the proper level of these sex steroids, they can feed back to the anterior pituitary, right? And we see a nice negative sign right here. So as their levels increase, you can see that the anterior pituitary is going to diminish the amount of FSH and LH that is going to be released, because its feedback, it's subtracting from the initial stimulus, which is GnRH. So that inhibits the responsiveness of the anterior pituitary to GnRH. All right, so this is a nice short feedback loop, but there's also a long feedback loop where the sex steroids feed back to the hypothalamus and diminishes the secretion of GnRH from the hypothalamus as well. Okay, and so this just maintains the proper levels of estrogens and androgens in the individual. Okay, except for one circumstance, and that is, in order to have ovulation occur, there has to be a very large spike in luteinizing hormone right at mid-cycle. And right at that stage of the ovulatory cycle, the feedback loop, right, this short feedback loop to the anterior pituitary of estrogens, right, turns into a positive feedback loop. So as estrogen increases, right, the anterior pituitary releases more luteinizing hormone, which causes more estrogens and progesterones to be produced, right, which then produces more LH and even FSH to some degree, but mostly LH right here. Right, and then that produces a huge level of LH, and then all of a sudden ovulation occurs as a result of that surge in LH. And the egg is released from a follicle. All right, so these feedback loops can change from negative to positive depending on the particular circumstances. All right, well, how come the whole world is not filled up with LH and FSH? All right, because here we have a positive feedback cycle, right, that is producing large amounts of LH. So what stops that from continuing forever and ever and ever? Yeah, as soon as ovulation happens, right, then that the organ that's responsible for, that has LH receptors, okay, it goes away. Right, so as soon as ovulation takes place, then LH really has no job to do. And then this turns back into the usual kind of negative feedback loop. All right, so something usually drastic has to happen to stop a positive feedback loop. And that thing that drastically happens is ovulation. And it changes, the follicle changes into a totally different kind of endocrine gland as a result. All right, where is the hypothalamus located? Where is it located? It's in the brain, right? So it's part of the diencephalon, so it's right up there in the brain. So it's very close to other higher level brain functions, right? Like your consciousness. So the hypothalamus receives input from the higher brain centers that can affect the anterior pituitary gland, like emotional states, psychological stress. These things can affect circadian rhythms, can affect menstrual cycle, the ovulatory cycle, and even adrenal hormones. Okay, because the hypothalamus is really part of the brain. All right, the posterior pituitary, we said, stores and releases two hormones, antidiuretic hormone, which promotes water conservation by the kidneys. Right, so antidiuretic does what? It keeps you from peeing. Right, a diuretic makes you pee. So when somebody becomes dehydrated, and ADH is released, so that has a tendency to bring your conserve water in your body. Oxytocin stimulates contraction of the uterus during parturition and is also important for the milk letdown reflex. So when I say reflex, what the heck does that mean? What's a reflex? What's necessary for a reflex? What does it always start with? And what does it end with? A response, right? So you've got, so you have a stimulus. In order for the stimulus to work, what does there have to be? What's a typical response loop? You've got a stimulus, okay? If I have a flashlight right here and I turn it on and shine it at you, what do you have to have in order to appreciate that light? You have to have a receptor. That's right. So the milk letdown reflex has to have a receptor, and it's just a pressure sensor, right, on the breast, and it's stimulated by suckling of an infant on the breast, and those pressure sensors then send afferent signals, being an afferent neuron, to the brain, where there's an integration center, and the integration center then says, oh, well, you've just had a baby that's trying to nurse, you better start nourishing your infant, right? So then the signals go to the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus then causes the release of oxytocin, and that causes ejection of milk from the breast, which is the response, right? So just think of it in terms of a typical kind of response loop. And this response loop right here works in positive feedback mechanism as well, right, to feed the infant. Because what happens to the infant when all of a sudden the infant realizes that there's milk on the breast? Do they become bored? No, they become more interested and nurse even more vigorously, right? Which produces what? More input to the hypothalamus, which releases more oxytocin, causes more milk ejection, and the infant nurses even more, okay, which causes more milk ejection from the breast. So you might be wondering, well, what happens? How come the whole world is just not filled with breast milk as a result of that if it's a positive feedback cycle? What happens in positive feedback cycles? Something drastic has to happen to break the positive feedback cycle, and what happens? Well, the breast can only produce so much milk, right? And when the breast runs out of milk, what happens to the infant? Gets bored, falls asleep, okay, and then hours later, the whole cycle can repeat itself over and over again. Okay. So here we have our pituitary gland again. We got the anterior pituitary and our posterior pituitary. And the supraoptic nucleus, right, because here's the optic chiasma right here, it's just superior to the optic chiasm, produces antidiuretic hormone, which then moves down the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract. What's a tract? What's a tract compared to a nerve? A tract is myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system, right? So we consider this central nervous system right here. And so ADH moves down the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract where it's stored in these axon terminals, right? But when these neurons are stimulated, action potential comes down the tract, reaches the axon terminus and releases ADH, where it's picked up by a capillary in the posterior pituitary, and then that's taken throughout the whole body. Oxytocin is synthesized by the paraventricular nucleus. Para means on either side of the ventricle, and I tell you what ventricle is this right here? That's the third ventricle, right? So these nuclei are on either side of the third ventricle, paraventricular nucleus, for synthesizing oxytocin, and then it's stored down in these axon terminals until this neuron undergoes an action potential. Okay, and it's released by the reflexes, for instance, that we were just talked about. All right, so that's the pituitary gland. a little fast, but not too bad. Right, the pituitary gland is controlled by the hypothalamus. The anterior pituitary gland is controlled by what from the hypothalamus? Anterior pituitary is controlled by releasing hormones or releasing factors. The posterior pituitary, right, is just controlled by action potentials going down the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract into the posterior pituitary. So you should know all of those different hormones and the effects on target tissues, and you probably should know something about that short feedback loop and long feedback loop. Okay. The adrenal gland, of course, we see sitting right on top of the kidneys. There's an outer cortex and an inner medulla. And the cortex has a number of different layers, right? It's got, and we don't consider this connective tissue capsule really part of the endocrine function of the adrenal gland. That's just a capsule around the adrenal gland. But here is the cortex. The cortex has the glomerulosa superficially, the fasciculata in the middle, and reticularis is the deep layer. All right, glomerulosa, fasciculata, and reticularis, and these secrete different hormones. The medulla, as we talked about, releases epinephrine and norepinephrine when there is an increase in sympathetic tone. Remember that the sympathetic nervous system gets activated en masse when there's any kind of sympathetic increase in tone anywhere in the body, right? And that stimulates the adrenal medulla, right? The cortex is controlled by ACTH from the anterior pituitary. Cortisol is one hormone that's released from the cortex that inhibits glucose utilization and stimulates gluconeogenesis. So cortisol is going to increase blood glucose levels. And we're going to see under what conditions that happens. Aldosterone is the second hormone. Well, I'll tell you what, let me go back to cortisol. So because it regulates glucose metabolism, sometimes we call cortisol a glucocorticoid. A glucocorticoid. Corticoid because it comes from the adrenal cortex, and its effect is on glucose metabolism. So that's a glucocorticoid. Furthermore, what kind of hormone is a glucocorticoid or cortisol? What class does it fall into? A glucocorticoid. Does it have a cytoplasmic receptor or a membrane receptor? Can anybody kind of just remember? You don't have to know the structure, but you should at least know the proper division that hormone comes from. It's a steroid. All right, so it's a steroid hormone. It's derived from cholesterol. All right, so it has to have a cytoplasmic receptor because it can go through the cell membrane. And how does it work? How does a cytoplasmic receptor work? What does it do to the cell? Yeah, it activates transcription. So cortisol works as a transcription factor when it binds to its hormone receptor, and then that binds to the DNA to cause transcription. Okay, the same thing for aldosterone, but aldosterone doesn't work by regulating glucose. It works by regulating sodium and potassium. So aldosterone is not what we call a glucocorticoid. We call it a mineralocorticoid because it works on these minerals right here, and corticoid because it comes from the adrenal cortex. All right, so cortisol is a glucocorticoid. Aldosterone is a mineralocorticoid. Yeah.
Does cortisol prevent insulin from working?
Well, it does produce insulin resistance. Okay, and it kind of it antagonizes that system because it's putting so much glucose into the blood. Okay, so it would be like eating a candy bar. All right, so your blood glucose levels are going to increase when cortisol is high. So it exacerbates the control system for glucose. Is there another question? Okay. All right, but the adrenal cortex also synthesizes some sex steroids, in particular androgens. And an androgen is what kind of sex steroid? Is it male or female? Yeah. It's a male sex steroid, right? And males and females have adrenal cortexes, so that's where male sex hormones come from in the female. And what's the purpose of that? That produces aggressive behavior in women. When do women demonstrate aggressive behavior? More so than you would ever see from a male. Like when? Like when they're protecting their young, okay, for instance, right? So that kind of behavior certainly is necessary for perpetuation of the species. Okay. All right, so here is the a flow diagram of the adrenal cortex. That's just something interesting to think about. Okay, and probably without testosterone, there might not be a lot of aggressive behavior in anybody. That's sort of interesting to think about. But that's more like psychology than physiology. All right, so here we have the zona glomerulosa and the zona fasciculata and reticularis. So the glomerulosa is what? The superficial. Fasciculata is the middle part. Reticularis is the deep part of the adrenal cortex. And these parts of the cortex produce mineralocorticoids. Give me a specific example of a mineralocorticoid.
Sodium.
Okay. That is what's going to be manipulated by a mineralocorticoid. But what is, give me a name of a hormone that is a mineralocorticoid. That works by adjusting sodium and potassium in your body. It is aldosterone, right? So you could maybe pencil in aldosterone as a specific example right here. All right. A glucocorticoid. Who can give me the name of a specific example of a glucocorticoid? Yeah. Corticosterone and cortisol right here. These both have the same kinds of effects. These are glucocorticoids because they work by controlling glucose metabolism. All right. And then we have sex steroids, which are right, just going to be androgens, right? So that's the bottom line. But notice in every particular case, the precursor molecule to all of these synthetic pathways is cholesterol. All right, so you should know zona glomerulosa produces aldosterone. And by interconverting different forms of steroids from one form to another, minor modifications. All right, and aldosterone actually is made from a glucocorticoid, like corticosterone. And corticosterone is made from progesterone, right? And progesterone is a female sex steroid, right? But it's not released from the adrenal cortex because eventually it gets converted into aldosterone. All right, the fasciculata and reticularis, through other kinds of pathways, produce the glucocorticoids and androgens by different modifications, basically, of cholesterol. And you can see how they're interconverted from one form to another. All right. The adrenal medulla, we said, releases epinephrine. And the cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic cells in a typical sympathetic outflow pathway. But when it releases epinephrine, it doesn't bind to a target tissue. It gets picked up by the blood, and the blood transports that chemical compound all over the body. So in a sense, epinephrine in this case is acting like a hormone, right? Where it will bind to adrenergic receptors. And those are going to be cell surface receptors. You know, there's the alpha type and the beta type. And of course, for the test, you got to know something about beta 1 and beta 2 and something about alpha 1 receptors. Okay. And epinephrine lasts a long time, 10 times longer than norepinephrine in the circulation. So if you've ever experienced a life-threatening episode, like if you ever thought for sure you're going to get crushed by some traffic on the 405 freeway or something, you probably notice that your heart rate is elevated for a really long time as a result of that. Another name for epinephrine would be adrenaline, because it's coming from the adrenal medulla. All right, so that produces the fight or flight response, and it produces it all over your body, right? So that's one characteristic of the sympathetic nervous system, is that it produces broad-ranging effects everywhere. It's not a targeted effect on one particular organ, but it affects all organs pretty much at the same time. And one reason is because of that epinephrine that is acting like a hormone. So what are some of the effects of flight or fight? So when you're presented with a life-threatening circumstance, what happens to your respiratory rate? It increases. And why do you think it increases? Because you're going to deal with that threat. You need a lot of oxygen available to produce ATP so that muscles can work, so that the brain can function properly. So respiratory rate increases. All right, heart rate. And the force of contraction increase. Right, that increases something we call cardiac output. The heart pumps more blood. And so that just helps with nutrient and oxygen delivery to all the tissues that you need to deal with this stress. It causes also a general vasoconstriction. All right, so that has an effect on blood pressure. All right, so how can you think that vasoconstriction causes an increase in blood pressure? So think of a balloon. Grab a balloon with two hands and start to squeeze on that balloon. You are doing what to the balloon? You're constricting the balloon. And think what might happen to the pressure of the air, or maybe if you have water in that balloon, what happens to the pressure inside the balloon as you squeeze down on it? That's fairly intuitive, I think, anyway. Should the pressure stay the same, go up, or go down? As you squeeze on the balloon, the pressure goes up, right? So the same thing happens in your body. When you have a generalized vasoconstriction of blood vessels, blood pressure goes up, right? That helps perfusion of tissues that need a blood supply. The other thing that it does is that veins have a tendency to vasodilate, and blood pools in veins under most circumstances. But when you have the flight or flight response taking effect, you have a more pronounced vasoconstriction of veins, and that returns all that pooled blood back to the circulatory system. So what effect might that have on pressure? Right, as more blood is basically taken out of very flaccid veins and put into the circulatory system for circulation, what might happen to blood pressure? Okay, so think of your tire that you have on your car, and you notice that it's a little flat, so you stop at a gas station on the way home, right, because you need to boost the pressure up. What do you do to your tire? Do you take air out, or you put air in? Yeah, you put air in to get the blood pressure up. So as veins constrict and return blood to the circulatory system, that also boosts blood pressure back up to maintain circulation. All right, so that's what that general vasoconstriction does. And then we saw that epinephrine also causes glycogenolysis, right, through the beta receptors and alpha receptors, and it also causes lipolysis, which increases blood glucose. Can you remember that slide? Where was that slide at? Way back before the pituitary, which was right here. Okay, so epinephrine, remember, can work through these two different second messenger systems, which converts glycogen into glucose. And what do we call the conversion of glycogen into glucose? That's glycogenolysis, right? Okay. All right, so that takes us to the slide that we were on, right here, glycogenolysis. All right, the thyroid gland. Thyroid gland is controlled by what hormone? From where? It's controlled by thyroid stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary gland. Okay. The thyroid gland, all right, is just below the larynx. All right, it's kind of on the anterior side of the pituitary, just below the larynx right here. And it secretes T3 and T4. T3 and T4 set basal metabolic rate, and T3 and T4 are needed to promote growth and development. Right, so both of these are needed for growth and development. The thyroid gland consists of microscopic follicles. And let's see, what's a follicle? A follicle is just a circle of cells that has this free space on the inside that's filled with a fluid. That's what a follicle is. All right, the outer layer has these follicular cells that synthesize T4. The interior part is filled with what we call the colloid, the fluid. It's a protein-rich fluid. So here's the colloid, and here are the follicular cells. The follicular cells, right, synthesize T3 and T4, and it's put into the colloid right here. And in order to make T3 and T4, right, there has to be iodide in the blood, and that's transported into the colloid, and there it's oxidized and attached to tyrosine residues of the thyroglobulin molecule. All right, so the colloid stores large amounts of T3 and T4, and they're released when TSH is released from the anterior pituitary. So let's look at this flow diagram right here. I don't know, is this an exam figure? Does anybody have your exam figures handy? This might be an exam figure. Okay, so let's look at some feedback loops. All right, so the hypothalamus releases thyroid-stimulating, releasing hormone. Your book just calls that TRH. You could call it TRF if you wanted to, or TSHRH. That would be okay with me. That goes to the anterior pituitary via the portal blood vessel. And that causes release of T3 and T4 from the thyroid gland. And if iodine is present, then this T3 and T4 are efficient stimulators of basal metabolic rate and other target tissues in the body, right? And moreover, they can feed back to the anterior pituitary, which then, what, diminishes the release of TSH, which then diminishes the release of T3 and T4 until the set point is reached. And so this negative feedback loop maintains homeostasis and the normal functioning of the thyroid gland. All right, but now let's just say that somebody doesn't have iodide in their diet. Can you make iodide? Can you make iodide? No, it's only, you have to have a dietary source for it. Okay, as a matter of fact, the only place that it comes from, I won't tell you because it has no place in physiology. But maybe you might be interested. Where does iodine come from? If you look anywhere in the universe, if you go, oh, there's an iodine, where did that come from? It comes from a supernova of a star. Okay, so it's interesting that that little control atom or element in our body, you know, it didn't even come from our solar system. It came from some solar system in the eons of history, the evolution of the universe. All right, so, but if iodine is not present, okay, then this T3 and T4 don't operate. It can't feed back to the anterior pituitary, right? So what is the anterior pituitary seeing? It's not seeing this negative feedback loop. It's only seeing this stimulatory effect from the hypothalamus. And what is that telling the anterior pituitary to do? To release thyroid-stimulating hormone. That's going to cause hypertrophy of the thyroid. Right, it's going to tell the thyroid to get going and start making some T3 and T4 because there's none in the blood. So the thyroid gland is going to grow and get bigger, and it's going to release compounds that don't have iodine on it, so it doesn't feed back to the anterior pituitary. So the thyroid gland grows and grows and grows because the negative feedback loop isn't established, so there's excess thyroid-stimulating hormone from the anterior pituitary, which causes even more growth of the thyroid gland, right? But without iodine, what about T3 and T4? Is it being made? Without iodine, can it be produced? It can't be produced, right? So that doesn't shut down this stimulation from the anterior pituitary, so the thyroid gland gets bigger and bigger and bigger trying to make thyroxine, which it can't make because it doesn't have iodine, and it gets huge. It can be as big as the two fists that you have on your hands, and they're located in your neck like that. And that condition is what we call goiter. So goiter is a result of this negative feedback mechanism not working because iodine is not in the diet. So if that's the only condition, how is that easily treated? Just by giving iodine to the person, okay? Yeah. What kind of foods have iodine in it? Well, you know, in the United States, it's really hard to get away from iodine because it's fortified in table salt. So every time you buy salt from the grocery store, it has more than enough iodine in it. Okay. Now, if you buy salt from a health food store, that's like sea salt or special kinds of salt, it might not have iodine in it. And other foods that have iodine, what are some other foods that have iodine? Yeah, spinach, okay, vegetables from the ocean have a lot, like different kelps, and kelps are incorporated into a lot of other kinds of foods, like even milkshakes and things like that, because it gives texture to different kinds of products that we eat, okay? So in the United States, goiter is almost something that we never see, but because people move and transport themselves really rapidly because of airplanes, right? You might see somebody with a goiter walking around because people move from one place to another really, really quickly. Okay. But I can't remember the last time I saw somebody with a goiter because it's so easily treated. But I have seen people with goiters. Okay, so that kind of answers your question. It's not much of a concern. Unless you're really a health food fanatic and you only eat certain kinds of salt from a health food store, then you might end up with goiter. What do we call that? That is irony, right? And that's not because of iodine, but that's irony. That's like a literary technique that can be used to highlight certain kinds of things.
So if you're vegan, for example?
If you're vegan, maybe you could end up with a goiter because you don't have proper iodine, and somebody's a vegan to be what? Healthy. Yeah, that's so if you have strange diets, you should probably still take vitamins and minerals in a tablet form to keep yourself healthy. Okay, so so that's a thyroid gland. Let's see, let me look at this slide right here. Okay, on the posterior side of the thyroid gland, there are the parathyroid glands. I don't have a picture to show you where they are. All right. But they release parathyroid hormone. And parathyroid hormone helps maintain proper blood levels of calcium in your body. So you should realize that the proper level of electrolytes in your body fluids are important for what particular reason? What are some electrolytes? Sodium and chloride, right? And even calcium is an electrolyte. But why is sodium and chloride important, the proper levels in your body? Because what do they determine? They determine, and even before an action potential, they determine the resting membrane potential, right? And remember, sodium's got to be high on the outside, potassium high on the inside. And in order for cells, for an action potential to move down an axon, you need to have changes in permeability to these two ions across the cell membrane. So you have to have proper levels of sodium and potassium. But not only that, but calcium as well. Why do you need to have proper levels of blood calcium? Well, you might say bones, yeah, because bones get calcium from the blood to be strong. But that's like the last place I think you need calcium is bones. You need it for muscle contraction, right? You need it because that calcium signal is, we didn't talk about muscle yet. That's in the next chapter coming up. But you need it for muscle contraction, okay? I let the cat out of the bag. What else do you need it for? Synaptic transmission, right? For a chemical synapse. You need to have calcium ions entering the synaptic terminal to get neurotransmitter release. All right, so there are many other processes where you need proper levels of calcium in your blood. And bones are actually a good place to go and find calcium when it's deficient in your diet. Okay, so calcium is really important as well. Parathyroid hormone acts on bones, the kidney, and the intestine to increase blood levels of calcium because you need that for synaptic transmission and even muscle contraction. All right, so parathyroid hormone is going to cause demineralization of bone to release that calcium into the blood. All right, and it's going to cause the reabsorption of calcium from kidney tubules, and that puts it back in the blood, and it's going to increase the absorption of calcium from your intestines. All these effects are going to increase blood levels of calcium. So the initial stimulus in this feedback loop is decreasing blood calcium is going to stimulate the parathyroids, because the parathyroids have receptors for calcium. Parathyroids release parathyroid hormone, and that hormone has various target tissues, namely the kidneys and bone. Parathyroid action on bone causes demineralization of bone that puts calcium into the blood. Right, the kidneys, the effect of parathyroid hormone on the kidneys is to cause increased reabsorption of calcium. So what this means is that there are a lot of little tubes inside the kidney. I don't know what you can remember back from anatomy, but the basic structure and functional unit of the kidney does anybody know, structural and functional unit of urine formation in the kidney is the nephron. So there's a bunch of little tubes, and plasma runs into the nephron, okay, and whatever in that nephron is going to be excreted from your body. But if there's good things in the nephron, what does your body want to do? Take it from the nephron and put it back in the blood. We call that reabsorption or resorption. All right, so that's taking stuff out of the precursor to urine, which is filtrate, puts it back in the blood, and that would include calcium. All right, so both of these effects increase blood calcium, and then you can see this is a nice negative feedback loop that affects the parathyroids, okay, which maintains proper level of calcium in the blood. All right, so that's the job of parathyroid hormone. It causes the breakdown of bone. Okay, another organ that we're interested in is the pancreas. Okay, so the pancreas has an exocrine function as well as an endocrine function. So guess what we're going to talk about in this chapter? The endocrine function of the pancreas. All right, so you can see the pancreas just below the stomach, and you should know a lot about the anatomy already of the pancreas, where it's located in the various ducts. These ducts are important for the exocrine function, right? This is how digestive enzymes and bicarbonate leave the pancreas into the small intestine. But the pancreas also contains endocrine cells and these little islands around inside the pancreas. So we call these the islets of Langerhans. And these islets have basically two different kinds of cells. There are alpha cells and beta cells. This might be a review from lab for you guys already, but it's good for you to know. The alpha cells secrete glucagon in response to low blood glucose levels. So glucagon has a number of effects. All right, so how could, if your blood glucose is low, what should you do? What should your body do? Put glucose into the blood to maintain the proper level of glucose. And where is a good place to go get glucose? Where's a storage form of glucose? Like, for instance, the liver, because the liver has glycogen, and glucagon causes glycogenolysis, right, as well as lipolysis, which increases blood glucose levels. So glucose increases blood glucose, and we're going to talk about another hormone, namely insulin. And you can imagine what the effect of insulin is, because what's a perfect kind of control system? Is it a tonic control system or an antagonistic control system? Think of your car. Antagonistic, right? So if glucagon increases blood glucose, you should have another hormone that does what? Decrease blood glucose, and that is insulin. Right? And insulin comes from the beta cells. It promotes entry of glucose into the cells of your body. So if glucose leaves the blood and goes into a cell, what happens to blood glucose levels? It goes down, right? Because other tissues in your body are taking it up. All right. It also causes the conversion, or promotes the conversion of glucose into glycogen and fat, right? So that again decreases blood glucose levels. All right, if glucose goes into glycogen, what do we call that process? What is that process called? Glucose into glycogen. Glycogenesis. Glycogenesis. Ooh, kind of a blast from the past. That's not on this test. That's the previous test. All right, so remember, you got glycolysis, glycogenolysis, gluconeogenesis, and what was this one right here? Oh, you got to really think. I have to think. Glucose to glycogen is glycogenesis, right? Okay. All right, and all of these things decrease blood glucose levels. So here we have blood glucose, and the stimulus is going to be an increase in blood glucose. How could you increase blood glucose?
Diet.
I could give you a piece of chewing gum, right? Or a piece of candy, or any kind of meal is going to increase blood glucose, right? So when you're in a fed state, blood glucose has a tendency to increase, right? That stimulates the beta cells in the pancreas, right? Because there are glucose receptors in these cells. These cells respond by secreting insulin. And where's insulin going to go? Is it going to go into the small intestine via the ducts of the pancreas, the pancreatic duct? Or where does it go? It goes directly, it's absorbed by capillaries in the pancreas, it goes directly into the circulatory system, and is transported everywhere in the body. And insulin then binds to those tyrosine kinase receptors, the GLUT4 transporters are inserted into the cell membranes of various cells, so that promotes cellular uptake of glucose from the blood. All right, so what does that do to blood glucose levels? It decreases, right? So that's the response. How does the response compare to the initial stimulus? It subtracts from it, so that's a nice negative feedback loop, maintaining the proper level of glucose in the blood. All right, so as the liver takes up glucose, it's converted to glycogen, right? That's glycogenesis. And in adipose tissue, of course, adipocytes love to gobble up glucose from the blood and convert it into triglycerides, which then are stored in the adipocytes. Okay, so this is a nice negative feedback loop. Oh, that's it? That's it. Do you have a glucagon slide? Oh, okay, so that's it for this chapter. All right, so those are the major hormones that you got to know about. There is a sign-in sheet going around. Okay, who's got the sign-in sheet, the yellow piece of paper? It's way in the back, so who needs the sign-in sheet? Wow, we could have the test on Monday. But we'll have it a week from... Oh, we can't have it Monday because we don't meet on Mondays. Tuesday. All right, so we'll have the test still a week from Tuesday. Right, a week from Tuesday. That's going to be November 3rd. Yeah.